This is Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com.
Greetings, super friends. My name is Sonia Simone, and these are the confessions of a pink-haired marketer. For those who don't know me, I'm a co-founder and the chief content officer for Copyblogger Media. I'm also a champion of running your business and your life according to your own rules. As long as you don't lie and you don't hurt people, this podcast is your official pink permission slip to run your business or your career exactly the way you think you should. And I am really delighted today. I have a friend with me, Annie Hyman Pratt. Annie, good talking with you today.
Great to be here.
Annie is somebody, she's in a business owners group with me, and she's one of those people who has a lot of expertise and a lot of real world experience without necessarily a big platform or, you know, a best-selling business book to share with you. And I am doing my best to nag Annie to get those in place, but it may take a while. She's the CEO of Impact Entrepreneur, that's I-M-P-A-Q, Entrepreneur, and they specialize in business execution and rapid culture change for fast-growing entrepreneurial companies. And she offers something special because unlike the sort of run-of-the-mill business advice giver, she has been there. She has been in the trenches leading a company through, you know, amazing twists and turns. And in fact, I would love it, Annie, if you could talk a little bit about that, about your experience with Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, because it's a pretty cool story.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. Yeah, Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf. My parents started it in the 60s. And all during the 60s and 70s and a lot of the 80s, we sold mostly just pounds of coffee. The cups hadn't kicked in. But then during the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, the beverage revolution hit.
Right.
And we were really well positioned to take advantage of that. So at that time, I came back to my family business. I was in my early 20s and started to grow the business like crazy. When I came back, we had about 7 stores and each doing pretty low volume. And over 7 years, we grew it to more than 70 stores worldwide with some overseas licensing. And each of those stores had grown so much in volume.
Yeah.
And then it was a really good time to, we got an offer from one of our overseas licensees, and we ended up selling the business at that time, which was a very opportunistic move. And that, you know, that growth period was so fun, but also fraught with all kinds of change and pain and all kinds of things that we had to handle as we were going along.
Yeah. And I think that's probably, that just gives you a perspective I think very few people have, because you've been the leader of a little company and you've been the leader of a big company and you've been a leader of a company in like multiple kinds of transition.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, and navigating all those kind of twists and turns is something you have given me some great advice on, given friends of ours some great advice on. So I'm going to jump into a couple of questions, starting with your thing. The way that I view your thing is really about creating business cultures that work better because they're more adaptable.
Yeah.
You know, they adapt to these stresses and pressures. Is there a key difference that you have seen between a company that can adapt to chaotic change or pressure and the ones that get stuck and start to sink?
Yes. Yes, there's a few things that I think make a really, really big difference. And I'm glad you shared that I really like to work in the real world. And
yeah,
one of the things about working in the real world is working with real human beings, like how human beings operate.
Right.
And so that's something to keep in mind as I share this next part. That is that it used to be that companies with super sharp leaders at the top, they could utilize a lot of authority and control and have what's known as cascading accountability. So very much top down, people just take direction from whoever is above them and do what they're told. And as long as you do that, it'll work out. But today, change is so rapid, like change in the external environment, things change so fast that it's a top-down approach, a controlling approach is too slow. It's just too slow. So we really need people at every level, not just leaders, but really everybody at every level to be able to know exactly what they're going for and to be able to take action in direction of the result, to basically take actions consistent with results. And we need to do that through an environment that's all about alignment, agreement, and accountability, and developing basically collective behaviors that facilitate that culture.
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack there. So we're going to unpack a little bit today.
Sure. Great. Yeah.
And we'll come back and talk a little bit more about some of those things. Before we dive into specifics, it's probably my own baggage, because anybody who listens to this podcast knows I have baggage about the corporate world. But it strikes me that a lot of leadership and a lot of business culture is pretty horrible. Like, just a lot of companies don't work well. Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think that this, you know, things like this very rigid top-down structure that's not flexible, that's not fast, it's not accountable really, except in a kind of a clumsy way, it's so common?
Yeah, it is. And the cultures, right, the cultures that I see that are so awful, so to speak, are the ones that where people get pretty entrenched in victim behaviors.
Okay.
So, you know, so that means that where people within the company, they spend a lot of time in blame or in denial or judgment or rationalization. Yeah. They're quick to finger point and criticize, but not so quick to step up and think about what they themselves could do differently to move towards the result. And those victim behaviors, there's something that we as humans, we do those. I mean, we fall into those loops. I know that I do. You know, every day I have to think about when am I blaming something? When am I hiding from something? When am I denying that something is even happening to me? And pull myself back to a place where I can recognize really what's happening and take action on it. You know, so the companies that don't have an understanding and of how their people are falling into these victim loops, then they can't work with it to basically develop a culture that gets people out of that.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of leaders and companies, managers, whether high-level leaders or mid-level managers, they definitely see the culture, right? They definitely see the culture of everybody's pointing a finger at everybody else and nobody will step up.
Yes.
I think they don't always see the role they play in that, in creating that.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Because in the moment, it's a lot easier to just think, this doesn't really have to do with me. It's not my fault. I don't really have a part in it. And the thing that helps people get out of that the quickest is to really go back to what are we really going for here, and what can we all do together differently? So adding more blame or self-blame tends to perpetuate the problem while the problem still goes on. One of the habits of cultures that are so strong and good is for everybody to be very staying out of a place of blame and judgment and going very quickly to what part of this can I own? What part is my part, and how can I be part of a solution here instead of ignoring or denying that I'm part of it at all?
Right.
It's really about stepping up to, you know, what's my part and how can I contribute to getting a better result here?
Yeah. And a word that I know comes up a lot in what you teach and in your workshops is safety.
Yes.
From my experience in working with a little bit larger organization, that's something that is maybe in short supply in a lot of organizations. The sense of, for example, safety to speak up and say, I think we're making an expensive mistake here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that's basically safe to risk, right?
Right.
Safe to go ahead and speak up when something isn't, you see something that doesn't seem like it's working well or should be happening. It's safe to go ahead and suggest a new ways of doing things or solutions that might be better. Safety, one of the things about safety is that it's not the same as comfort.
Right.
So what safety really means is safe to be uncomfortable and to risk and try something different. So that could mean risk being more transparent. It could mean risk trying a new behavior that maybe you aren't sure if it's going to work out or not. Safe to take a political risk and speak up in a situation that might in the past have been a little bit less safe. That's what we mean when we say safety.
Yeah, it's such a key idea. And I read a lot of business books and I don't see that spoken to as often as I think it should be.
Yes, I agree. And unfortunately, I sometimes also see it spoken about when it's framed in a way where safety is not about, is providing comfort, actually not about providing an environment where people are safe to try something different. In fact, I love Simon Sinek's work, but he has a video out now that's all about safety. And he talks a lot about having people be very safe in their jobs, like safe that they have a job. And the thing about that is that it's the external environment keeps changing and people really know when things are going on that is going to put their job at risk, when things have to reorganize in a way that is very uncertain about the outcome. So the kind of safety that we can provide is it can't be like a false safety, right? It can't be a safety that ignores reality. What it is a safety to confront the truth and be able to risk in it, to be able to try something different and risk in a way where people are safe from blame, criticism, judgment, all those kinds of things that tend to have people put people right back down into the victim loop,
right?
Instead of trying to do something a lot more productive.
Yeah, I don't know if you are familiar with a book called Billion Dollar Lessons by Paul B. Carroll.
I'm not.
It's a kind of a little volume of Schadenfreude, basically, of like terrible things that companies have done. It's amazing how often it comes down to there were people in the organization who absolutely saw the oncoming train, and they had no way to get that communicated. They either tried to communicate it and they weren't heard, or they didn't try to communicate it because they knew it was politically not astute.
Right.
And so, you know, any of us in any kind of a leadership role, and I think you can take a leadership role as a peer among equals, but I think anytime we can step forward and maybe just own our own insecurity enough that we can say, you know, it's okay to tell me the truth, even if I'm not thrilled about it.
Yes, right.
You know, because that's hard.
Oh, yes, it is. And it's okay to tell me the truth. And even if I have, you know, my first reaction is denial or blame or whatnot, I'm going to be working on getting myself to a good place with it.
Right.
It's like starting with a good self-awareness for what's even at risk here. Like what people are likely going through. Frankly, the best way out of that lower loop, out of those kind of victim behaviors, is to start with a lot of compassion for what is happening.
Right.
So when somebody comes to me and tells me the truth of a situation that's a tough one, like they just lost a major account, I've certainly had lots of people tell me that before.
Yep.
And that has a very large impact on how we're going to do for the quarter or the year. There are times when my first reaction is wanting to blame that person.
Right.
Like is going right to an interrogation of like, well, what did you do? How did you lose it? As in, it's your fault. And I've had to learn how to hit a pause button. And I really want leaders to cultivate this, is getting a pause button and starting with sharing just what's happening inside you. It's like, oh my gosh, this is a big piece of news. This is a big deal.
Right.
Like, you know, give me a minute to process it and think about, you know, so that I can interact with you in a way where we can both think together where to go from here.
I like that. I like that pause button. I think everybody needs a pause button.
Yeah.
You know, we are an emotional kind of a critter.
Yes. Yes.
We do react. You know, our first reaction is often not maybe constructive.
Yes.
Mine often is not constructive. And just being able to take that pause, take a breath. I like that, just acknowledging, okay, I've just, you know, taken in a big piece of news. So I need a sec. Just let people know. Because I think if you're just silent, that's probably very intimidating or creepy or worrisome.
And they're going to assume when you're silent, the other person is assuming the worst.
Right. Right. Sure.
Yeah.
Like we would, like we all do.
Yes, like we all do.
You know, I like that pause. It seems to me like a kind of just a key habit that you can put in place. Are there any other kind of habits that you would want to share that people can just start to do better with some of this? Because a lot of what we're talking about is, it's easy to see that that would be a good idea, but we might not have the right framework or the right personal habit set to make it work.
Yes, yes. I have a couple other that are helpful. So in addition to hitting the pause button, there's another habit that's all about recovery or repair, right? So it's like, just because you have a reaction, and reactions run automatically, they are kind of hardwiring.
Yeah.
You know, there certainly have been lots of times when I've gone very quickly to blame or judgment or general freak out, causing a lot of fear in the person standing in front of me.
Yeah.
And to pretend that that's never going to happen is just not even practical, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see that happening, or when I've engaged in a behavior that isn't working, so to speak, I very quickly then head to a recovery plan, right? So I, for myself, I'll go to something like, oh my gosh, you know, hey, I'm having, this is a, again, this is a big piece of news. I think I'm, you know, that was not the best reaction there. Let me take a moment and start over. Let me get myself centered and start over.
Yeah.
So there's just something that simple of a habit is so, so, so useful. Mm. And you'll find that the more times you actually deploy the recovery, the better you'll get at not falling into those behaviors in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't hit the pause button, definitely go for recovery. Then there's another habit that I think goes with those two as well. And it also kind of rides on what we were just sharing about, and that is to articulate what you're thinking out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is, when you're, especially when you're engaged in anything that's kind of, you know, high stakes, it's either high stakes or highly emotional or just something critical going on. So then it's really helpful to articulate what's going on inside your head. So it's like, okay, given all the information that you just shared with me, you know, telling me that we've just lost this big account, let me tell you what I'm thinking about that. You know, the first thing I'm thinking is that, you know, our revenue for this quarter is totally at stake. And the next thing I'm thinking is that, because of that, now I'm worried about covering the sales department salaries. I'm worried about that part. And to just start articulating what you're thinking, right?
Yeah.
So that the other person has, and you can articulate your feelings as well, and saying, you know, and I'm in my example of, you know, and I'm scared that maybe we're going to have a difficult time covering payroll for this department. That's a way for the other person to start seeing what's happening inside my head, right? And as I'm articulating my thinking, I'm much less likely to fall into the emotionality of it, to right be driven by the emotions. Because when we're articulating our thoughts and feelings, we're in a part of the brain that's rational, that's
right,
logical, that's able to connect to the helpful part of what we're going for. So putting some process on it and just articulating what you're thinking out loud, how I do this a lot when I'm making high stakes decisions.
Right.
I'll say, you know, here's the decision that I made, and here's how I've come to it. This is what I was thinking as I was making the decision. And it adds super important context for everybody around you to understand, you know, what the heck was going on. And it also starts to set a wonderful example for other people to start doing the same. It's also the most rapid way to negotiate, because you start to share hidden pieces. Companies that have a habit of openly negotiating interests, right? And where they're able to share, like, you know, how they're coming to how they're thinking, it's so, so, so much more effective than just gunning for your position.
Right. Especially because I think we have to get realistic about the fact that employees, you don't just, I mean, we started off with this. You don't just say, go do this, and then they go do it exactly the way you wanted them to and make all the right decisions and all the right judgment calls. It's a big enough to ask them to do that. But if they are doing that with no context, it doesn't work, you know, and companies
That's
kind
right.
of expect it to work. It won't work.
Right. It doesn't work. Context is everything these days. The outside environment shifts so fast. The more people need context so that they can be good decision makers in the moment. That's what makes the difference between a great company and a so-so company.
Right.
Is when people are confronted with challenges and they can actually make good decisions in the moment.
Right.
But to do that, they've got to have context, because you can't think up every circumstance that they're going to be in. And so sharing what you're thinking and how you've come to your decisions or how you've gotten there, it's one of the quickest ways to teach people, to give them so much more context about how, how your part is. And then they're going to do the same with you.
Right.
And you're going to hear so many things that you had no idea of were happening at a level, or how, with things that impact a decision that you had no idea about.
Yeah. No, I've really, really seen that, where the C-level of the organization is really struggling with some very difficult scenarios. They're not sharing what's going on, so their employees are all in a state of permanent panic.
Yes.
And so they're not doing a good job.
Yes.
Because that's not how to get the best out of people. And the stories the employees are telling in their heads are probably worse. I mean...
Oh, they're 10 times worse.
Yeah. The reality was tough, but it wasn't as bad as these stories. But then on top of that, there were great solutions available on the front line that never made their way up.
Yes.
Because the employees didn't have that habit of letting their managers and even on up to the C-level know the real context of what was really going on. And there were solutions there that just weren't able to be seen because these practices. So I want to stress to people, I think that your approach could sound, and it may be the thing that you're talking about in the Simon Sinek piece, it can be soft or fluffy or kumbaya, or, yeah, this is great if you've just taken like $50 million in venture capital and you don't know what to spend it on.
Sure. Yeah,
you know. And I want to stress that these are important habits and frameworks and structures for very pragmatic, tough situations. This is not just like a nice to have, fluffy Easter bunny kind of way to run your business.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things about this approach that I think is so different than an autocratic approach is that in this kind of approach where people are involved, people are, they're accountable at all levels to take action that's consistent with the results. When you have that kind of environment, you can be much more non-negotiable about the outcome.
Talk about
that. It's like what we're going for here, especially because it has to take into account what's the external drivers, like what's happening in the marketplace.
Right.
So the outcome that we're going for is non-negotiable. Like, this is the part that is, we have to do it. We have to get there.
Right.
How we get there is negotiable. And that's where we need everybody's help.
Yeah.
But what it is not negotiable. So, a simple example of that is when I work with a turnaround.
Right.
So I come into a company that's losing a lot of money every month. Okay. That is not, we can't sustain that. You know, again, unless you have just taken in $50 million, then maybe you can. But for most business owners, you can't lose millions of dollars every month and have that be okay or sustainable. So we have to get action on it. The fact that we have to turn around this picture is not negotiable, but how we get there is. And that's the part where we need everybody's involvement so that the fastest, best, and most efficient solutions surface the easiest. And we actually can't get those to surface if we're not sharing the real, honest truth of the situation to the people in it.
Right?
Because otherwise they're going to offer up solutions that are so far away from the reality. I find this all the time where companies don't share the magnitude of the situation because they're really worried about causing panic, which I totally understand. I totally understand. When they do that, then people generally offer up solutions that fall so far short.
Right?
And they're not very creative because they don't really know what's at stake. But when you share the real truth and share such a strong intention of how we're planning on dealing with this and how we're going to keep you involved, then people have enough safety, again, not comfort, but enough safety to offer up real solutions that even include them making sacrifices.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really a lot to think about. And I think it's a lot for people to get their heads around. I'm going to pause here and just remind people that the Confessions of a Pink-Haired Marketer are brought to you this week by Authority Rainmaker, a carefully designed live educational experience that presents a complete online marketing strategy to make your business and your marketing work. So I really hope you will take the advantage to come see me, come see copy bloggers founder Brian Clark, authors Dan Pink, Sally Hogshead, punk legend Henry Rollins, which ought to be interesting, and a lot of other really smart speakers live, not to mention the secret sauce of the whole thing, which is real-world relationships with other attendees. I personally would love to connect with you there. So you can go snag all the details at rainmaker.fm/event, and we would love to see you in Denver, Colorado this May. So rainmaker.fm/event. And now let's dive into some more of Annie's insights. And one that I am a total victim of this. This is something I find very appealing, this kind of myth of business, which is that basically if we all get into a room and share our values, then we're going to turn into Zappos. Like it's just going to happen for us, you know? And I'm kind of guessing that there's more to it than that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. There is. I know. And I love values. I love values. When I was with Coffee Bean, it was one of the first processes that we did was, you know, creating our values. And we even had an acronym for it. It was HIROS, HIROS, humor, integrity, respect, openness, and service.
Nice.
I loved it. And then, you know, a year or two later, I was noticing that our values had become a little bit of a joke in the organization.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Because things were really tense. Sort of humor was the last thing that we were bringing to it. As, you know, as I was asking people to step up and deal with kind of crisis after crisis, because the growth was going so fast, our values became this thing of like, well, yeah, I wish we could do our values, but there's just no way this, you know, this is not, it's just not possible to do it here. So here's the thing about values. The first thing is that they're aspirational and they're really up to interpretation for each person. How I see the value of integrity might differ than how you see the value of integrity. Mm-hmm. And certainly the way I would demonstrate the value of service could be really different than you would demonstrate the value of service. So values on their own are lovely, but they don't provide any direction or any support for people in how they behave.
Right.
And what we really want are to turn those values into behaviors. Mm. If you're embodying the value of service here at Coffee Bean, what does that mean in your behavior? How do you behave? What do you do to demonstrate that? And then turning that into a collective behavior so that everybody knows how to demonstrate service.
Right.
Your values are basically your collective behaviors.
Right.
And the bummer thing is if you've got a company that has a lot of victim behaviors going, then that's one of the things that kind of shines through. And that's the thing that can make the values that you do have kind of feel like a joke.
Yeah. Your company's values are much more what you're actually doing than what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Much more what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
And that's something where most people think that changing a culture or getting people to behave differently is something that takes a super long time. And we all recognize that behavior change is hard, right? I mean, at times I've tried to change my own behavior, which I'm constantly doing. It's certainly not easy. It's not easy. But with a good amount of safety and with a strong articulation of expectations for how these behaviors should look, like what we're really going for in behavior, you can get there quite rapidly, more rapidly than people realize.
Yeah, that's so fascinating to me, because for a long, long time, I have been preaching and teaching that your marketing is really everything you communicate to your customers or your prospective customers. But what you do communicates as much or more than what you say. So people think their marketing is like their web copy and their brochure copy, but it's how your person answers the phone.
Yes.
And how the person gives you change in the restaurant. You know, it's what people are doing. It's how people drive when they're driving one of your delivery trucks. That's marketing, negative or positive.
Oh, gosh, yes, right. And people's experience inside our stores was enormous for that, right? Mm-hmm. Like we could deliver great drinks, but if the store was a mess,
right,
it's not that great.
You have a lot of experience with companies in turnaround, companies in crisis, companies in panic mode. And I'm thinking that there are probably some portion of the people listening to this right now are in an environment, an organization that's having one of those kind of hot moments where there's a lot of stress or pressure. It doesn't need to be that the company's going down, but you know, there's something very stressful or pressuring in your department, in your organization, with a vendor. These come up all the time.
Yeah.
Is there some little chunk of advice you can give somebody, and this could be an owner, it could be a manager, it could be an employee, to keep themselves productive and keep that situation as healthy as it can be?
There's a couple of things. First is just noticing your reactions to the truth of what's happening, mm-hmm. right? Kind of what we talked about a little bit ago. When the news is coming in, to recognize what's happening with you, but to not let that stop you from trying to seek the whole truth.
Right.
Trying to just get the whole truth of the situation. And then the next thing is to really try to understand what's important and focus on the outcome that you're going for.
Right.
That will really help keep you and everybody around you out of blame, criticism, judgment, denial, all of that. It will really, and no matter what level, where you are in the organization, you will be a huge support. If you can keep helping to surface the truth and then helping keep people focused on the outcome that they're going for. If I could come into a company that was struggling with a really difficult situation, those would be the first two things that I'm always looking to do, always looking to help them.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's a lot more we could talk about, but I'm going to cut it off here for a couple of reasons. One is I would like Annie to come back and talk to us again. So if you would like Annie to come back and talk to us again, leave a comment and let us know. If you are listening to this on iTunes, you can bop over to pinkhairedmarketer.fm. That's where you find the show, where you can leave a comment and just let us know, what would you like to hear more about? What are some of the problems, challenges, stuck spots that you would like her to help out with? You can also connect with Annie at impactentrepreneur.com. I will, of course, leave that link in the show notes, but it's impact is IMPAQ and then entrepreneur.com. And it's all one word, no hyphens or spaces or anything. And of course, your ratings and your reviews on iTunes are very welcome and they are very helpful. So thank you for everyone who has left a review and a star rating. And if you feel moved to do that, I would encourage you to go do that. I just want to thank you. I always get so much out of talking with you, and I'm really appreciative of the time you've taken today.
Yeah, thank you. I get so much out of it too. Thank you so much.
Oh, fun. So thank you, everyone. This is Sonia Simone with The Confessions of a Pink-Haired Marketer. Take care, everybody.